Welcome to Inside Seaweed. This is the podcast where we talk about the incredible world of seaweed and how this growing industry is bringing innovation and solutions to address climate change and the environmental crisis. My guest today is Rhianna Rees. She's the coordinator of the Seaweed Academy at the Scottish Association for Marine Science. Before joining SAMS, she worked a few years in education, first in Hong Kong and then in Bangkok. She then moved to Sweden, where she received a master's degree in global environmental history from Uppsala University. Rhianna is also author of the thesis Seaweed is Sexy, the consumption and utilization of seaweed throughout British history and the marketing that surrounds it. Rhianna, welcome to Inside Seaweed. Great to have you here.
Thanks very much. Pleasure to be here.
So tell me about the Seaweed Academy. What is the Seaweed Academy?
Yeah, so I mean, it was a really interesting concept that I think came from the fact that the Scottish Association for Marine Science is, as it's developing its marine research, we're seeing more and more about seaweed and people are getting more and more excited about seaweed. And with all this research that we've got, you know, there's a lack of understanding or a lack of this dissemination between research and industry that I think industry is really calling out for. So as we start to scale up, as we start to develop, one of the biggest gaps in all of this is this understanding, is this educational piece. How to cultivate responsibly, how to scale up efficiently, how to bring down costs. And so while on the research side, we're trying to figure out all of these things, you know, what's the optimal stocking density, depth, we can package that in a form, or at least in a format that industry can tap into, utilize and understand. So I've been brought in to help understand, disseminate all this information from the research side and offer a series of courses for industry, which is a really great opportunity.
So when you say industry, who is it for really? Are we talking seaweed farmers or is it more than that?
I think it's more than that. We've already seen a wealth of interest from across the sector. Investors who want to understand more before they start investing, people who are doing PhDs or masters who want to understand a little bit more about what's going on in the research side. We're seeing farmers, I've got fishermen who are here, but people in the processing side who want to understand a little bit more about, you know, what could be utilized, how we could get biorefineries going. So it's a really hot topic at the moment. It's really exciting and there's just so much buzz around it. And while these are packaged as an introduction to seaweed cultivation, it's really open to everyone.
So very much an introduction. Okay, let's use me as a hypothetical example of someone who is getting started in the seaweed industry. I'm interested, I want to learn more. What are the initial considerations I should be taking into account before I decide to become a seaweed farmer or let's say a seaweed entrepreneur in general?
I think that the three biggest things you have to focus on before you step into this is whether you have the correct funding, whether you have the right time frame, and whether you have the right knowledge. Those are your three key factors. It's a lot more time consuming than I think people understand. There's a lot more funding that's required than maybe initially expected. And the gap in knowledge, you know, it's not about going and spreading seeds in the ocean and seeing what grows or just putting ropes in the water. There's a lot more to it. And you're trying to mitigate risk, basically. If you're going to invest all of this money, if you're going to spend all of this time, you need to make sure that you have something at the end to show for it. So that's really what, if you're looking at initial considerations, those are the three key factors that you need to focus on.
Okay. Do you see any of these three as a significant barrier to entry?
Yeah, there's quite a few, unfortunately. And that's equally something that we're trying to at least encourage people entering the industry to be really innovative about. If we can give people the utilities to understand exactly what the barriers to growth are, then they can use their innovation to try and solve these problems. But one of the biggest ones right now is social licensing. You know, social license to operate, it's great that's being introduced. I think it was ignored for quite a long period of time. We saw the salmon industry grow and people being really unhappy about it. We saw other you know, oil and gas, the way that they've been operating, we haven't required that social license before. So it's really nice that we have that. But at the same time, I think people associate any sort of maritime or aquaculture activity with these big, slightly polluting industries like salmon. And what we're trying to do, I guess, as the seaweed industry as a whole, is operate and try and build small scale farms. But if we want return on investment, if we want economic sustainability, we need a certain scale that I think social or communities won't accept. So if we're walking this fine line at the moment, I think we're going to start to see it come out in the wash a little bit here. You know, what's the sweet spot where we can make an industry that will be economically, environmentally, and socially sustainable in the long term? And I think that's the biggest barrier. I can talk about all sorts of other barriers as well, processing, but for me, until we can resolve that, we're going to be in a bit of a tight spot.
Okay, so mostly an educational barrier, maybe PR, even perception sort of element. How do we get around that one?
Yeah, I mean, potentially education is probably the best way to approach this. At least education, or at least having things backed by science. If we can get the message out there and the science to back it up, then I think people will listen to it. Although, you know, we've seen in the past, science doesn't always solidify people's understanding of things. You know, it took a while for climate change to be understood by the wider population. So there have been some issues at the moment in terms of, or at least in recent years, in terms of mechanical harvesting. You know, and we did see essentially a trial by social media. We saw David Attenborough get involved in some of these discussions about how to cultivate and how we should be interacting with the environment. So it's just understanding what can be done, what should be done, and what the science says about how it could be done. And then also, how do we get that message out there?
You mentioned the financial aspect in a very brutal and simplistic way. How much money do I need?
Oh, that's a good question. It depends completely on scale.
Okay.
You know, the bigger the farm is, the less it's going to cost you per square metre. But realistically, you know, we're looking at tens of thousands of pounds at least to get started. It depends, again, also which country you operate in. There's lots of differentiating factors, but yeah, tens of thousands of pounds.
And you see a big difference between, in terms of barrier to entry between different countries? Could European seaweed farmers get a much higher barrier in terms of starting a farm as opposed to, I don't know, someone in the States?
Well, the States has its own issues. You know, I think anybody who's tried to start up a seaweed farm in the States knows that the regulations are pretty tight. And I thought European regulations were tight in terms of gaining licenses, but some of the wait times out there are, you know, up to 10 years, which is pretty extreme. And here, you know, with COVID and everything having affected things, you're still waiting a year or two more than you might have before. But it comes down to how prepared the industry is for it and how much people understand. It's a very niche industry. So as the regulators are trying to understand it, they're a bit more apprehensive to give away licenses because they don't want it to come back onto them, essentially.
You mentioned licensing, so let's dive into that. Is this a long process? You almost already answered the question. How long in advance do I need to start thinking about licensing?
Again, it depends on the area. I would probably say give yourself 2 years. I would hope in 2 years you'd be able to resolve it. It usually comes down to case by case what the issues may or may not be. You really have to show that you've done your due diligence in terms of social licensing. Your public application consultations need to show that you've listened to the community, that you've taken on board everything that they've said, that you're operating responsibly in an area where there's going to be an element of acceptance. And if you can't show that, then people, the regulators are going to be really apprehensive to give you that license. So I realistically 2 years should be enough time, but that's no promise by any means if things go wrong. And yeah, the feedback is always, if you've done everything that you need to do at the beginning, then you shouldn't have to redo it. Unfortunately, no one knows exactly what they should be doing at the beginning, and it seems to change every other month. So yeah, as I said, it's an ancient industry. Yeah.
With that in mind, then, will I need help? Or is this something I can do on my own?
I mean, there are people who have done it on their own.
Does it go back to the knowledge gap you mentioned?
It comes back to the knowledge gap. This is why we've set up the Seaweed Academy, to give people as the tools, or as much as we can, to help them get past this, or at least get past those barriers. However, there are still people who have set up by themselves and have done a really good job. But again, it comes back to that economic sustainability. There aren't any industries, at least in the UK at the moment, who are really making money from seaweed at a level that we'd like to see. So with that gap, that's the point that we're going to see that longevity. As soon as we meet that demand and we get the roots to market, then that's when we're going to start to see real growth in the sector.
Again, on licensing, we sort of touched on what the process might look like. It sounds like it's not just paperwork, but it's also engaging with the community, having a very good understanding of the site that I may have picked for my farm and how it may affect the community surrounding, but not only that, I guess the infrastructure, the ecosystem surrounding that, presumably. I'm just making this up on the spot. Tell me if I'm talking rubbish.
No, it's spot on, it's spot on.
Okay. I'm assuming, contrary to land farming, I won't own the bit of the ocean I get a license for. Do I even get exclusive use?
You should do. Yeah, absolutely. That's what the agreement will require, that you take into account who else is operating in the area, whether it will affect anybody else's operations. You know, there's a lot of creel fishermen around the west coast of Scotland. So where we are, we've got two commercial scale farms near Sam's that we operate. So we've got a 36 hectare site that we've leased from Crown Estate, and we've got a 2 hectare area. And in both of those, we're trying different farm designs. We're doing some IMTA systems, which is integrated multi-trophic aquaculture, which, if any of your listeners tuned in for Terry Chopin, that's his specialty. Yep. I think he even coined the phrase.
I think so.
Yeah, so we're trying out different species, and that's again one of those risk mitigating factors. If you can't make enough money from seaweed, at least you've got other routes to market that you could potentially profit from. So that if something goes wrong, or the market's not just quite set up yet, you have other ways of making money. So what's really great about having access to those is that we get a really good insight into how to use that space. But we've got creel fishermen operating around the area. So while we've set up that farm, we can see the issues that lie with having such closeness in the aquaculture space. So while we're working on that, I think other industries are working on that. How can we make co-location work, for example? I know that there's a lot of people that are talking right now about wind farms and reutilising wind farms, because obviously fishermen won't go in that space. They won't operate in that area. But is that a risk then to wind farms? And the questions that are kind of coming and going with that. So we'll see how it goes in terms of infrastructure. But there's potential there, I can see.
Okay, so you mentioned integrated multi-trophic aquaculture. Is that something, going back to the licensing piece, is that something I need to sort of think about in advance? Do I need to make it part of the license that I'm intending to not only farm seaweed, but also maybe have mussels and oysters and scallops? Or is that something that I can maybe evolve later? Is it part of the package?
Yeah, any activities that you partake in, you'll have to let the licensors know. There is an argument that it might be more beneficial for your licensing process to have those things there, because equally the leasing organisations are all about making money back. If they lease an area to you for whatever you're doing, they take a percentage of your profits. in exchange for that. So they obviously want you to succeed and you to make more profit, so that they also make more profit, you see. So there is a benefit to having more than one activity going on to show and to demonstrate that you're bringing an economic incentive to your farm and to the area.
More revenue streams.
Exactly.
Okay, let's say I've got my license granted. What's the next thing to do? Is it time to start growing?
No, then you'd probably need to go to the nursery, okay. Or at least find someone who can propagate and grow your seaweed. So there's a few different ways of outplanting seaweed at the moment. Well, at the moment, there's one, and that's twine, because it's a solid way of outplanting seaweed. You know, you've got a pretty high chance of it growing. So you'd buy that twine, that seeded twine from a nursery, and not a hatchery like people like to say, because you're not hatching anything. They're not coming out of eggs. It's growing on twine. And then you helically deploy it along a piece of rope in your pre-decided farm setting, and then have it there usually during the winter for it to grow fully.
Cool. Couple of things come to mind. How do I pick the seaweed species to cultivate?
Yeah, so one of the requirements is always going to be biosecurity. What's your biosecurity plan? And one of the biggest biosecurity measures is finding local endemic species. So what grows in your area already, and making sure that even when you send off those samples to a nursery, that you take a good quality piece of seaweed from the area that you're planning on growing in. Usually no more than 2 kilometres away is what we say, or up to 2 miles away. So we have a nursery facility at our site, which we currently propagate seaweed for our own farms and then for farms in the area as well.
Right. Is a nursery always an external contractor that I'll be using, or is that something I can do on my own? Do I need special facilities at all?
So yeah, there's quite a lot of requirements to setting up a nursery. So the reason why we set it up is because we needed so much seaweed each year anyway. You know, we're always trialing different farm designs, so we need lots and lots of different species. We also have a cryopreservation site, so our facility, the cultural collection of algae and protozoa, where we keep cryopreserved cultures for long periods of time. So equally, if somebody has a strain or a specific strain that they need to maintain, then they can put it in the cryopreservation chamber. So in terms of why we did it, that's why we did it, because we saw that there was not only that, but there was also a gap in the market for one. There's a lot of biosecurity measures that you need. You need to make sure you have proper sterilization, UV filtration. You need to have a really biosecure environment, and it can take 6 to 8 months really to propagate fully and grow that seed of twine. So the amount of labor that you would need to get behind it, usually, unless you're cultivating 1,000 tons or more each year, it probably isn't worth the cost and effort to set up your own seaweed nursery.
Yeah, right.
It's one of those down the line type things, I think.
What do I get from a nursery? What's the final product that I get back?
So you normally get a culture, either a propagated culture in a set, you know, if you're going to, it depends where you're coming from, really. If you're going to go farm it at the site, deploy it at the site and cultivate it, mm-hmm. then you're going to get that twine. You'll buy that twine. We're currently working on some direct binder seeding using what you would call it a seaweed glue, what we all call a seaweed glue, to make sure that it goes straight onto the rope, and that reduces some of the costs.
Seaweed glue.
Yeah, so yeah, exactly. So using a seaweed glue, we plant direct onto the rope. So instead of having that twine, you mitigate some of those costs. And then also you have less chance of plastics, because you won't have nylon in the seaweed when you cultivate it. But other people might want a whole cultivation. If you know, if you're rewilding a seaweed forest or something like that, then you might just buy the spores themselves.
All right, so far our slice of ocean is still out there doing nothing. How do we go about farming? Will I need a tractor?
I mean, not at the moment, but maybe down the line. I think I've seen so many different visions of hydrogen-powered drones that travel underwater, circular farm designs. I think it's really exciting where it's going, but we haven't really changed the way that we farm seaweed for the last 100 years, so we're still going to see the same stuff.
And what is that?
So you're going to have your grid pattern. So, I mean, in the past, we've always hand harvested. Now we're cultivating out to sea. Let's say we've got your grid pattern or your muscle long line pattern, mm-hmm. or, you know, you've predetermined what your seaweed farm's going to look like in terms of the farm design based on the area. You've put in those moorings. Then now we're just going to deploy everything, maybe in a zigzag pattern with some mussels going on, maybe in a grid pattern, something like that.
Okay.
So we look at a few different things when we're looking at deployment. We're looking at nitrates, nitrogen levels, we're looking at salinity, stratification, and we're looking at temperature. So those three things there. And we'll look for clues that now is the right time. We want it to be 10 degrees or below, usually, if we're deploying kelps, others for different species, but for those big brown seaweeds, we want quite cool temperatures. We want to make sure that there's enough nutrients that have circled around and come up from the bottom of the ocean. So this usually will happen, I'd say October, end of October time, up here in Scotland at least. And we'll take our twine out when we can see the signs. We deploy it in our pattern, and then hopefully we pray that there won't be any storm events, and that it'll attach really nicely to the rope. So those 2 weeks after deployment are key.
Because you mentioned a couple of interesting parameters that I need to be aware of, I need to watch out for. The nitrogen nitrate concentration, a number of other parameters, stratification, I believe. These to me sound like things I should have been thinking about before. Is that right?
I mean, as long as you've got hobo sensors or something else that are out at the site, but you should really be able to find this information around your area. If you have farmers, fishermen, fish farmers around the area, they should have all this information anyway. Mm. Whether or not they want to share it with you, that's another question.
Okay.
But there are, you know, there are sensors you can find, not for nitrogen, but for salinity and for temperature. There are sensors from the sky satellite sensors where you can see all this information as well. So there are a few different, and as the technology develops, we'll start to see more and more of this stuff as well.
Are these parameters key in picking the right site as well?
The site should be relatively universal along the whole coastline.
Okay.
I don't think you're going to find too many parameters in terms of salinity, temperature that are going to affect that, unless you start to look at species that don't grow as you travel further south, you know, into warmer waters. That might be the defining area, but you know, you're not going to go within a small stretch of ocean. You're not going to go from one to the other, you know. Then you go far enough apart that you know it, you know, Alaria definitely grows up here and doesn't grow down there, because you want to be really sure of that.
Okay, so there's no chance that I would get everything ready, go out in my farm and start measuring all these different parameters and realize, oh, I picked the wrong place, or I haven't got the right conditions for my farm to grow properly.
Yeah, you would have this as part of the pre-licensing considerations. Yeah, so we go back to this. When you're going to whoever your regulators are, they're going to say, why did you pick this spot? And there are other factors as well. So if the mooring companies will look at what the seabed is and what moorings you need to have in there, you should probably think about that too. But you need to do some kind of seabed analysis for that respect. You'd want wave rider buoys. Ultimately, you don't know if anything will grow until you actually grow it. You know, I think that's one of our biggest phrases. You don't know until you grow. So it always requires some kind of pilot line. I would always recommend putting in a pilot line first to make sure that a season before you plan on putting out your entire farm, the season before, that you actually get growth, that it's successful, and that, you know, you're not getting too many biofouling organisms or anything like that. But that's usually down to what time of year it is and the temperature and everything else. So as long as you harvest early enough, you're probably not going to have too many concerns about that. But ultimately, yeah, it's the, if you're looking at area, if you're looking at site selection, the best way to do it is just to go out and grow it.
Go out and grow it. Okay. So let's say I've done that. When is my seaweed going to be ready for harvest? And also, is it only once a year?
There are areas in the world where we've seen multiple harvests within a year. So ocean rainforests, up in the Faroes, they do multiple harvests. And it's possible up there, you know, whatever it is, whether it's the cold water, whether it's the lack of biofouling organisms, you can coppice, which is where you cut the seaweed and let it regrow. Around here, the water gets too warm for that. You're going to start to see all these biofouling organisms that, it depends on the quality of the seaweed, but it's not going to be good for your seaweed. The best thing really is to take it all out in one go and cultivate everything. Take that rope, take everything off and reuse it next year and reseed everything next year. Now, that is expensive. It's not efficient. It creates a huge bottleneck because then you've got, you know, 60, 70 tons of seaweed or whatever it is that you've harvested at that time that you then need to process all in one go. And that is one of the biggest issues, that seaweed, as soon as you cut it, starts to degrade.
How long do I have before it goes off?
It depends on the species and it depends on how you're storing it. But I would say between 2 and 24 hours.
Between 2 and 24?
Yeah. Yeah, so certain species.
So that could be quite challenging if I'm in a remote area.
Exactly. So you can see, I think Alaria, as soon as you cut Alaria, it will degrade very quickly. So there are ways to keep it fresher for longer, keeping it in the water, maybe keeping it cool, refrigerated or frozen, will slow down that degradation. But you've got a finite time period between when you cut it and what you can do to stabilize it.
How long does the harvest last? Is it a day or two, or is it a couple of weeks?
It depends totally on the infrastructure that you've got. I've seen some people with, if the boat's really set up for it, if you've got a really good pulley system, I've seen some mechanical harvesting. And this is one of the things that we really need to see the industry develop. When I'm talking about innovation, I'm talking about stuff like this. Automation, mechanization. If we can get a mechanical harvest, and I'm not talking about the mechanical hand harvesting of Ascophyllum where you have basically lawn mowers on the shoreline. I'm talking about a system that pulls the ropes through a cultivator, through a harvester, and takes off all the seaweed and does everything automatically. If you have to do it by hand, it can take quite a few days, up to a few weeks, depending on the size of your farm. So if we can limit that time frame and make it shorter and also make the processing much more efficient or spread it out over a longer period of time, maybe by freezing it first before drying it, for example, then we're going to start to see the industry expand and develop and we'll start to see these kinks get resolved, I think.
So let's take the example of a small farm, somebody who is on their first or second year. How much seaweed are we talking about in terms of weight?
I mean, I would say if you've got a hectare of seaweed, I reckon you're probably going to get, I've seen a few different estimates, which again, from researchers, this shows sort of where we are. I've seen estimates from 20 to 30 tons all the way up to 80 tons. And it comes down to a number of different factors. What's your stocking density? What's the distance between each of your lines? How are you cultivating it? What are you growing? So, I mean, I think probably 60 to 70 is a safe estimate per hectare. But we'll start to see that improve as the research develops and as innovations start to come into play.
Okay, and that could take me a couple of weeks to harvest. What happens? Now, first of all, when in the year does the harvest happen? I suppose we're talking kelp in Northern Europe, just to give a rough, you know, as an example.
Yeah, exactly. So if you deploy late October, you're going to want to harvest around May. There are a couple of weeks in May, depending on the weather, depending on the temperature. Might be earlier, might be later, but really May, yeah. So approximately 6 months is the growing time.
What happens if I leave it too long?
Then you'll start to get those biofouling organisms. So I'm talking about, lump fish. I'm talking about bryozoans. Bryozoans are those kind of furry, moss-like structures that you start to find, especially on Dulse, Palmaria palmata. You'll start to see it on there. It does start to grow on kelp, and it's not very pleasant.
No.
I probably wouldn't want to eat that.
Okay, we don't want that. Let's say we've harvested everything. April, May, where do I take it?
So, if you've got a processing facility, you'll take it straight to your processing facility. Ideally, there'll be some kind of processing facility very close to your landing facility. So, if you're taking it to your pontoon or whatever it is, taking it off the boat, it should go straight to some kind of processing facility. And at that point, you will stabilize it. So, that's what we call primary processing. And stabilizing can be freezing, it can be drying. Up to usually wet weight, about you want about 80% dry weight at that point, 80 to 90% really to stabilize it. Or you can ensile it, which is where you ferment it in a some kind of container.
Is there a best or better way to do it? What are the pros and cons of, I don't know, drying versus freezing versus fermentation?
Fermentation is obviously one of the cheaper options. It goes in, you let it ferment in its own way, it gets ensiled. That's usually for animal feed. So in Norway, that's what they do with a lot of their seaweed. Most of it does get ensiled and then used for animal fodder. We don't really do that in this country, or much in Europe, but we might start to see that developing, as again the industry grows. If you want to dry it, it's probably the better of the three in terms of what you can then do with the product. It's got a very long shelf life, as long as you keep it dry. It's hygroscopic, so it starts to absorb water. So as soon as you put it in an area where there's any humidity in the air, it's going to start taking on that water. So as long as it's sealed correctly in a dry environment, then it will last a long period of time. Then you've got freezing, but freezing is labor intensive. You need a lot of space. You're not removing the water, and seaweed is, 90% water. So if you keep it in those areas, then you end up taking up a lot more space. And then yeah, but if the market requires it to be fresh at the time of usage, then freezing is better because then you can just defrost it and then use it.
What are the challenges here? Is it difficult to find processing facilities? Is it expensive? Does it require lots of energy? Yeah, what are you mentioned? This could be a bottleneck. What are the challenges here?
It's a huge bottleneck. It's expensive. It's the energy consumption is very big in all of these, and also the market requires them in so many different ways. One company might want it dried and milled to a certain particle size, whereas another might want it fresh. Another might want it frozen, and being able to combine all of those different routes to market, unless you've got one big buyer trying to accommodate all of those different stabilized products essentially, is one of the biggest challenges. So having access to a site or a facility that can do all of that for you would be an amazing thing. There are some projects now that are starting up that are looking at how to maybe provide that for people. And I think if we can see that, being funded by Marine Scotland or by the government, the governments are looking at infrastructure grants now. And I think if we can see that resolved, then we'll be golden. As soon as farmers know that they have a route to market and they know that they can stabilize it and store it somewhere, it'll be a lot easier to go ahead.
So it's definitely not something I can do myself. I will need to take my freshly harvested seaweed to a processor, assuming I can find one and assuming it will make sense economically.
Yeah, equally, there are companies who are processing themselves, but they tend to have their own route to market. So if you know already what you're going to do with your seaweed, like, I'm going to take the seaweed and I'm going to make it into a food product, and this is what the food product's going to look like, and I'm going to then use that seaweed beyond, I think you're golden processing it yourself. I think that'd be fine. And you know exactly what processing machinery you'd need and would be able to put that into your business model. If you're looking to sell on wholesale, then yeah, then it gets into sketchy territory.
I just want to paint a very sort of visual and practical picture for somebody very new to the industry. How does it look like when I've stabilized it after primary processing? Is it a liquid? Is it a powder? Is it flakes? Could it be all of the above?
Oh yeah, it could be all of the above. But primary essentially just means stabilizing. So I've dried it. I've stopped it from degrading in some way. Secondary processing is what you're then talking about. So what do people want it? The pharmaceutical industry might want the seaweed in a powder form, with a certain level of iodine or something else. You might have, another industry wants whole leaf dried seaweed or whole leaf frozen seaweed for then fresh consumption. So it's that secondary stage. That's when you're looking at how it needs to look. The first stage is literally just stopping it from degrading in some respect.
Let's talk about the market then. I've stabilized it. Let's pick one as an example. Let's say I've dried it. I've got a nice, I'm imagining some kind of powder or dry flakes. What do I do with my product at this point? I guess the first thing is, what can I do with it? And then I suppose, who is it going to buy it?
Yeah, exactly. And that's the million-dollar question. Who's going to buy my seaweed?
Yes.
And there's a number of different things that you can do with it. You can go for animal feed. We've seen bioplastics. Bioplastics are taking off at the moment. A number of industries now are being developed. The fastest growing SME at the moment in the seaweed sector is bioplastics. We're seeing nutraceuticals, food for human consumption. If we take the Seaweed for Europe report as a standard for routes to market in the future, food for human consumption is the biggest one of those portions, along with animal feed. There's different questions coming down to that. What are the requirements then for animal feed? Tends to be certain species of seaweed that have higher protein content. So you're looking at ulva, more green seaweeds that you don't really cultivate in the same way that you cultivate kelp. But it could be that kelp offers some lower carbon alternatives to, say, corn or something else that's coming from South America. So when you're looking at it, finding those routes to market is the biggest challenge. Who wants to buy the seaweed? Why do they want to buy the seaweed? What species do they want to buy? And you really need to have the market in your mind right at the beginning of this entire process. So when we go back to pre-licensing, who are you going to sell it to is the first question that you should be thinking of more than anything else.
Okay, that's a very important point.
Yeah, exactly. You might be putting it into an ingredient for something. It might be a salt alternative. It might be a iodine supplement. I don't know. There's lots of different applications here. It's just getting the educational piece out. Why would people want to buy seaweed?
I think this was a great introduction. I'm sure a lot of listeners will be thinking, okay, I'm in. I'm interested.
I would hope so. I'm either going to have bored them or put them off or made them really excited. One of the three. I hope I've made everybody really excited about the industry. We'll see.
How can they do it? How can the Seaweed Academy help me?
So all of these points, all these topics that I've covered, do get covered in the Seaweed Academy. You'll have access to researchers who'll be able to answer specific questions like about nutrient cycles or, what's the best sensor to use or what are the considerations with other marine users. So, these are the kinds of questions that if you need that hands-on approach, if you need to talk to people about that, and try and resolve those problems, and this is what the Seaweed Academy is there for, really. I hope to offer that industry to support, which is so needed right now. And that's really what we're trying to get past here. Yeah.
Are there any courses available at the moment? And if so, what courses are you currently offering?
Yeah, so we've already run two courses so far. We did a pilot course for people in the Argyle area, and that was really positive. So we did a pilot one-day course, and then we did a bespoke course for Aberdeenshire Council and some of the operators in the aquaculture industry up there. Again, very positive. So on the back of that, we're now offering a one-day course on the 5th of October for people at our in-person facility in Oban to just kind of talk through all of these, everything that I've talked about with you today. And then we've got a 1 week intensive course, and that's covering everything from pre-licensing considerations to blue carbon to IMTA systems, really, really intensive, but really all encompassing, I would hope. So that's on the 29th of August for the full week as well.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And is there, presumably there's going to be more after that one?
There will, as long as the feedback comes back all right from those, then we'll set up further ones, and then it'll be an ongoing process, I hope, after that, where we'll keep offering them on a regular basis. So as I said, you know, in this industry, you never really know where things are going to go and how things are going to change. So one of the biggest things is keeping up to date with all the research and making sure we're offering people the best value for money.
It's like we're part of a very, very big experiment, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Is there any thinking of providing maybe online courses in the future? I gather from what you said that these are all in person. I should probably ask where, if you haven't mentioned it.
Yeah, so to start off with, they're all in person. So Sam's facility is up in Oban at the moment, which is a gorgeous part of the world at the moment. It's beautiful when it's sunny. It's not so beautiful when it's not, which is most of the time, unfortunately, in Western Scotland. But, you know, you do get access to our sites, our facilities, which is one of the key things, really. And we're trying to bring that economic incentive to Western Scotland to begin with, and then the wider UK and the wider Europe and all around the world, we hope. So to begin with, the courses will be in person, but as we develop them, and I'm hoping by the end of the year, we'll at least offer the one-day course online and be able to give people that information over Zoom or Teams or whatever else we need to. There's so many different options at the moment, right?
I guess there's a big benefit in actually being there in person. Presumably, as part of the training, there's going to be some practical sessions where people will get to see an actual farm. Or
exactly.
Tell me a bit more about that.
Yeah, so in the 1 week course, you'll be able to go out to the farm. You'll be able to see the lines. Hopefully, there'll be some seaweed on those lines. It depends what time of year it is.
Yeah, yeah.
There'll also be the opportunity to also visit our nursery facilities as well, and talk about what the nursery does and you know, get the general scope of everything, as well as guest lecturers and researchers as well.
Will August be a good time to have a look at the nursery, or is it still too early?
No, August should be the perfect time. We're going to start propagating basically from now. So if you were going to deploy in October with a pilot line or something else, right now is kind of your cutoff point. You want to send us your materials now, so we've got enough time to make sure that it propagates and that it's ready, yeah.
Okay. Rhianna, this has been an extremely interesting introduction, and I'm so grateful you could make it. Do you have any final message or call to action for the audience?
Oh, that's a good question. Thanks so much first for having me on. I don't know if you can tell, but I get incredibly excited about seaweed. It is one of my big passions, and I hope that doesn't run out. But I do think that we're at a turning point right now. And I know that, again, if I talk about Thierry Chopin, he talked about the kelp boom of the 80s and how it came and went and how we're at this point again. But, you know, seaweed isn't a silver bullet. And I agree with him in all of these respects. But I really do hope that at the crest of this wave, it's not going to die out, and we are going to see it hockey stick up that way. And it really needs the inclusivity of everyone working together to solve these issues, to look at these problems and really to make it grow. And I think as long as we work together on all of these, then I think we're going to see a really great industry thrive and develop. And I hope to see
Absolutely. I mean, it's never been so needed. So it's going to be a very good time for it.
I'd hope so. Yeah.
Fantastic. Thank you again, Rhianna. It's been great. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much, Fed. Take care.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.